the former U.S. Surgeon General was David Satcher. It was very, very exciting, and just even more sort of energy and fodder to continue taking on this racism as a public health crisis. So if you weren't able to join, their recording will be on their website. So check it out. So I'm Jessica Collins. I am the Executive Director of the Public Health Institute of Western Mass. And I am here with just amazing teammates and all of you. And thank you so much for joining us today to learn more about how to use our COVID-19 data dashboard. And I know we only have about 60 minutes and we have a tremendous panel. So I just want to just very quickly go over kind of how this presentation will go. If you have questions, please put them in the chat box. We're going to keep everyone muted. And then as appropriate and timing allows, we will ask you to unmute yourself to ask your question, or we'll just read it right out of the chat box. So now I want to introduce to you a great friend, Dr. Christina Rebner-Torres. She is the Vice President of Research and Population Health at Caring Health Center, and she is also the President of the Public Health Institute of Western Mass, and she's going to be our moderator today. So Christina, I'm handing it over to you.
Buenos dias. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Jessica, for that introduction, and thanks so much to all of you for joining us today, including our panelists. I'm thrilled to be here with you and really appreciative of the work that Public Health Institute of Western Mass has done to create this COVID-19 data dashboard, and also for all of us to be together on their first ever webinar, which I know will likely be the first of many to come. So it's exciting to be able to be in conversation with each other on that. Taking time from your day to day, we know that there are a lot of questions about data and needing to discuss with a range of stakeholders that we all serve, that we're a part of, about how we're utilizing data in the state, in our regions. There are barriers so far that we've been experiencing around data, and many of us are taking different steps to try and find access accurate data and then translate that into meaningful next steps with our community members. I know for myself, as a community health leader and as a social epidemiologist, we're constantly trying to make decisions based on data, things like PPE, things like developing policy and keeping our communities safe, and how we deliver excellent care. So knowing that, I want to make sure that the data dashboard is a tool that is well understood and accessed by the community. We can ask questions today about how best to use it or questions about it, but also we're going to hear from Dr. Kathleen Zegda from the Public Health Institute of Western Mass about how the dashboard was developed and its functions and features, and we're going to hear from a panel of three presenters today. We're fortunate to be joined today by State Representative Mindy Dom, Meg Birch, and Gail Gramarosa. First, I'd like to start by introducing Dr. Kathleen Zegda to share with us about the development and the features of the COVID-19 dashboard. We'll then hear from our three panelists. And as Jessica mentioned, while all of this is going on, any questions that you have along the way, please put them in the chat box so you don't forget them. And then we'll collect those, and either we'll be able to ask all the questions given the number that there are, or if there are far more than what can be asked altogether, Jessica will make sure to identify themes of questions that are coming up and do our best to get through as many as possible. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Kathleen Zegda to share with us the COVID-19 data dashboard, and then we'll move into our panelist section and question and answer after that. Thank you.
Kathleen, sorry, before you go, I just want to recognize Senator Comerford has joined us, and with the multiple pages, if there are other leaders of such high esteem, I'm sorry, we'll recognize you as we see your name. So I just wanted to give Senator Comerford a shout out. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for joining.
Okay, so welcome everyone. We're so glad to have you and have you participate in our webinar. So I am going to be speaking to, hold on one second, I'm just going to pull this up, give a little bit of an overview of our data dashboard, as Christina was saying, and here we go. So how it originated. So we decided to do this data dashboard because we were hearing from people about need for data specific to Western Mass at a regional level. And we had several people reach out, and we were pulling together data for people and also just looking into what was available. And so based on what we're hearing, the state had switched their reporting and started providing more county level data. So we decided to try to pull together data in one place for each of the Western Massachusetts counties so that people could have information, relevant, timely information to understand what's going on with COVID in their county. So on the screen right now, you can see this is our website, and this is the data, county data dashboards that we have. And we have both for the state and then each of the Western Massachusetts counties. And what I'm gonna do is, because we have also county specific pages, I'm gonna go to one of these county pages as I talk about what the different boxes in the dashboard are, and then also just a little more information about some of the other data we have for each of the counties over with indicators over time. So for this, I'm gonna use Hampshire County as my example. You can see, so we update this every week and we do our best to get it up Thursday morning. The state releases their weekly report on Wednesday evening. And this information, some of it is in that report. So we do the best we can to update this. And so you'll see that we have the current 2-week period. There's a little bit of a lag with when the state releases their report and the 2-week period. They have to compile everything. And then they compare the data for this current 2-week period to the prior 2-week period. So for when they're indicating increases or decreases, that's what they're comparing to. You'll see that there's an overlap in these 2 weeks periods. And I just wanted to note that because there have been questions about that. And the way that the state is calculating their data and doing comparisons, they're rolling estimates or rolling averages. And so, even though the reports are weekly, they're reporting on each of those weeks for the prior 2-week period. And it's a way to be able, because there's going to be variability, for example, in cases on a daily basis. And so it's a way to smooth some of that out and look more overall at to see if there are increases or decreases over time. So next, I'll walk through what some of these different boxes are in our dashboard. So you'll see that there are columns for cases, numbers of cases, and also columns for tests. And these are really important to look at together to understand the information that you're seeing. And then we also have included information on the number of deaths that have occurred over the past 2 weeks as well. And so looking specifically at cases, this first box here is confirmed cases. And the larger number is over the last current 2-week period. And so these are confirmed by molecular tests. There are different tests that they can do to be able to identify cases. So there's molecular, and then there's also antigen tests. These are molecular tests. And then it's compared to the prior 2-week period, and then, which in this case is 52, and you'll see we've indicated there's a decrease. So for most of these, the arrows are indicative of whether it is an increase or decrease based on the numbers. You'll see when I speak to the percent positive that that's based on something a little different that the state uses. We also indicate the total number of confirmed cases that have occurred since COVID started, just as a way to put this in context to see. So you can see in the last 2 weeks, there have been 21 confirmed cases identified and the number comparatively to the total as a whole. So below that is the average daily cases per 100,000 people during the current 2-week period. So you can see that the number is 0.9 and it's pretty low, and it's lower than what it was in the prior 2-week period. and lower than it was for the state as a whole, a bit lower. And putting it into this rate is a way to be able to compare across areas with different population sizes. So the state uses this, and I'll speak briefly to that in their community map when comparing across communities. So moving to the next column are the tests in the current two-week period. Again, these are molecular tests. And so in this case, 32,742, a slight increase than the previous period. And then below that are the percent positive tests. And so in the two-week period. So among all the these tests that were conducted, what percent were positive? And you can see that has decreased since the prior two-week period, and it is a bit lower than Massachusetts as a whole. This will give a sense, again, it's based on the number of tests and the number of cases, so it really is dependent, and a part of it is on absolutely on the number of tests. And it indicates if there's a large, more community spread, but also testing capacity. So the benchmark used for this is to try and have that below 5%. And then you'll see that we've included the number of deaths and the number of cumulative confirmed and probable deaths as well. So for each county, we also have the data over time. So on August 12th, the state changed how they were reporting, and I believe it was August 12th, right around there. And so we're since that time, we've started to include and post on our website some of these data indicators over time. So it's helpful. So this one is confirmed cases in over the past two-week period. To get a sense of, are there trends in terms of number of new cases? So looking at the last 2 weeks, does there seem to be some a trend towards increase or a trend towards decrease? We expect there will be some variability. So you'll see this here. And then you'll see that it looks like there seems to be a trend towards decreasing. So it's important to look over time as well. And again, you see a corresponding decrease in the incidence per 100,000 that you can see is related to the number of new cases. And if you look at the test and over time as well, you'll see there's been a large increase over time. In Hampshire County, we see that, and what we know is that some of the university and colleges have begun asymptomatic testing. So that would impact potentially the number of cases you would see as well. So whereas before it was only among people who were showing up with symptoms and they would be tested, now we're seeing people being tested within some of the universities and colleges on a weekly, and in some instances, students on a biweekly basis. So who's being tested is important to know as well. And then you'll see below that the percent positivity over time. And so you'll see that that decreases as the number of cases has increased. And also it is important to then think about the number of new cases because that will impact that as well. But you'll see that in this case, the percent positivity was decreasing substantially as the number of cases increased. In addition to the county level data, we also have on our website community level data that the state is reporting weekly. So they have a map. I should note one limitation of the county level data that we currently have access to is that we are not able to disaggregate by race and ethnicity or age. So we're hoping that that will become available, but currently we are not. And so we're not able to examine some of the inequities that we know exist within our region as part of of COVID. So just quickly looking at this community level map, you're able to see based on, these are the categories the state has put out. So I had mentioned this is that average daily cases per 100,000 over the last 2 weeks. And green is indicative of when there are fewer than four cases per 100,000. Yellow is 4 to 8, and red is more than 8. And the state has put out some guidance to schools about whether being in person or hybrid or remote based on this. Gray is different. It is not a rate, and it is when a community or has a population of less than 50,000 and fewer than 5 reported cases. It can be challenging to interpret some of this in smaller communities because the case number could be really small, yet it could be that the color is red. We saw that recently with, for example, in West Hampton, where there were 5 cases in a 2-week period. Because the population is about 1,600 people, their average daily incidence was 21, but it was a small number of cases, and it's hard for communities to interpret, or even some of these where it's not colored. So that is just a brief overview of some of the data that we have available. It's meant to give a regional perspective with the county level data, and then also to be able to make easily accessible to people their community level data, and then they can just click on their community and see, again, this is what the state has put out, but we put this on our website, the total cases that have occurred in the last 2 weeks, and then also the average daily incidence rate per 100,000. And we'll have a chance to open it up to Q&A a little later. So Christina, I'll go ahead and turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. That was a really excellent presentation. And I know I can already see in the chat that a lot of people are commenting on the need for this. So hoping that this is really helping to clarify some of the important messages. I want to join Jessica in welcoming Senator Comerford as well as Representatives Fairley Bouvier and Blaze to the call as well. Appreciate everybody's attendance, to all of the attendees and to the a priority that this webinar is being given with your attendance. Much appreciated. And now I'd really love to introduce our panelists today. We're joined by 3 members of the community who are going to give their perspectives on 3 questions, and I'll pose those in just a moment. And the way this will work is each panelist is going to have about 7 minutes to share their thoughts, and they'll get a 1-minute cue for when they're nearly done with their time. And once all 3 have had a chance to present, we'll open it up to Q&A, which, as I mentioned earlier, if you've just joined the call, please place your questions in the chat, and we'll do our best to summarize questions individually or as themes as we go through. So first, without further ado, I'd like to introduce State Representative Mindy Dahm, who is the 3rd Hampshire District representative, including Amherst, Pelham, and Precinct 1 in Granby. Prior to being elected to office, she was the executive director of the Amherst Survival Center, where she oversaw delivery of a range of resources and services and basic need programs. Prior to that, she worked in the HIV epidemic since the 1980s, overseeing teams and testing in Western Massachusetts, providing community education, pressuring for federal response to the epidemic, and working with people in jail, substance users, and drug and alcohol treatment providers. So we are very fortunate to have you join today and are very interested to hear your thoughts on the questions that we'll be posing as it relates to the work that you're currently doing in Massachusetts and your perspective representing your constituents. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to introduce Meg Birch. Meg has been the district leader for the Frontier Regional and Union 38 District Schools for the past 5 years, a building-based elementary school nurse for 9 years, and is a nationally certified school nurse. Meg has been a guest lecturer in the nursing program at Greenfield Community College and serves on the nursing program advisory board. Meg holds an MS in epidemiology and worked as an epidemiologist prior to obtaining her degree in nursing. And in addition, she works for the school district. Meg is currently on staff as a public health nurse with the Cooperative Public Health Service in the Franklin Regional Council of Governments. She previously served on local boards of health and school committee. Thank you, Meg, so much for joining us today. Appreciate you being here. And lastly, I'd like to introduce Gail Gramarosa. Gail is the Evaluation and Technical Assistance Specialist in the Department of Healthy Children and Families at the Collaborative for Educational Services based in Northampton, Massachusetts. She also serves as the chair and the facilitator of the Quabog Hills Substance Use Alliance since its establishment in 2014 and serves as the program director of the Quabog Hills Drug-Free Communities Project. She's volunteer and co-chair of the Bay State Eastern Region's Community Benefits Advisory Council, and also serves 15 communities crossing Hamden and Hampshire and Worcester community. I'd really like to join you all in welcoming our three panelists to the call. And right now we're gonna hand it over to them to really hear their thoughts on three critical questions that you are all thinking about. One is, how are you and the people that you're working for or your constituents using the dashboard and the COVID-19 dashboard or just COVID data currently? What are the challenges of using the data or the challenges that you've faced with data so far during the COVID-19 pandemic? And what next steps are you taking or engaging in regarding COVID-19 data? So we'll begin with representative and hear your thoughts on each of these three questions.
Thank you so much. And hi, everybody. This is exciting that so many people are interested in not only getting the data, understanding it, and using it. And before I begin to answer some of those questions, I just want to thank the Public Health Institute of Western Massachusetts for their initiative in developing the dashboard, creating this webinar, really getting the word out. You're such a valuable community resource. And I'm hoping that for people who may not be familiar with your work, this dashboard is actually going to make them very familiar with it. So I just want to really express my gratitude. And also because it helps me and it helps my staff and my constituents understand what's going on in our community. So I think the way I use data is as a former HIV educator, and I've said this to some people on this call, epidemiology and data is critical. It's not only important in terms of our being able to develop policies that are data-driven and reality-based, but it can also be used to inform and build awareness in a community about what the experience of the pandemic is. And that awareness can be used to compel action. So that action can be either on the personal level to remind people to practice prevention or get tested, but it can also compel legislative action. I think that I look at the data every day. I try to put out information from what's going on up from the state report to my constituents. And I find my constituents are really interested in understanding the data. And as a result, I've also learned the many problems with the way the state is actually producing the data. It's not always in a user-friendly way. It's not always explained why they choose to include or exclude information at different times. And we're all aware that in this public health crisis, transparency is critically important. And the report serves that purpose, but when you start mixing things up or not explaining things in an easy to understand way, it's no longer transparent. It's actually very opaque. So I use it because I want to understand what's going on in the region and in the community. In Western Mass, the county data, I think any area outside of Boston, county data is critical. And I would prefer to see the state produce not only the race and ethnicity data and the age breakdown data, but monthly or weekly surveillance reports by county, including higher ed campuses, hospitals, et cetera, all the other data that they sort of put in different places. The challenges are that what I found is that we don't always get the data we need from the state, and we don't always get it in the timeframe that we need it. That is a problem. I know many legislators on this phone call, Senator Comerford and Rep. Lay, in particular from Hampshire County and Hampshire Franklin, we've been active in trying to request more data and more explicit data from the department. Those requests have not always been favorable. So in terms of the third question, next steps, then you go to legislation. You know, you kind of ask and say, "What, you know, is this possible?" You assume it should be because they have the data, but then you go to legislation and require it. And it's not clear to me why we don't get all the data we want. It's not clear if they are just sort of very busy and overwhelmed. So that reveals a staffing issue that the legislature could also sort of be supportive with, or if there's a reluctance to share. I don't want to go to the latter part, but I want to admit that my constituents have felt that way, that they have felt that the state has been hesitant to provide data that they've wanted. And so in the past, like a couple of months, I've introduced some legislation that's has been about data disclosure. One piece was around the Department of Corrections, which then the Department of Public Health started to do. And in the next week, I'll also be introducing legislation to require very specific county data. So hopefully that will be sort of a nudge, another nudge to the department, and they'll be able to release additional data. We need race and ethnicity data. We need age breakdown. They took out the age breakdown for the state just as K through 12 and higher ed campuses were opening. Makes no sense. We know that we want to be looking at all ages, especially in the younger brackets when schools are reopening. It disappeared. We certainly want that on a county basis. But we may also want to see towns on a county basis and other information that's available, but just not all put together in one place. On that, I just want to say how grateful again I am to the Public Health Institute for taking what is available and putting it together. And I hope that we can work together moving forward to get you more. If I can say one more thing, and I hope I'm not at my 7 minute limit. I've often said when I was in the AIDS epidemic that the epidemiology, sometimes people feel like they can't understand it unless they went to public health school. And I think you understand it much better when you have a public health degree, but it can be clearly shared with people who don't have a public health background to build their own sense of knowledge about what's happening. And that is critical to our ability to contain and combat the pandemic. If that tree falls in the forest and no one's around, does it make a sound? I think probably, right? But the data and the surveillance reports help to amplify what's happening in that forest. And if we don't have it, then we don't understand it. And then we can't meet needs that result from it. And that's bad government. And that's not really taking care of each other. So that's all I'll say. I'll stop and let my panelists go. Thank you.
Thank you so much for those comments and for that feedback. We're going to dive into question and answer after we hear from our two panelists, and I'd love to hand it over now to Meg Birch. If you could share your thoughts on those three questions or any combination of them based on your experience so far with things.
Absolutely. So I want to also thank you for inviting me here today, and thank you for the work that you have been doing in terms of providing the aggregate data and the information to interpret it. So I am from Frontier Regional School District, which is in Franklin County. There are 5 schools in 4 towns. We're not fully regionalized, so we have 5 school committees. We have 4 different boards of health that we have to work with just within our school district. But I did a little math to figure out that about 75% of our students live in district, about a third of our staff live in district. And aside from our 4 towns, we have 54 additional towns, municipalities that we could have to work with to respond to a case or a potential close contact within our schools. Fortunately for us, about 12 of those towns are part of the Cooperative Public Health Service, so that narrows down the players a little bit. But how I've been using this data is starting in July, school committee members and community members were asking the district how we were going to make decisions about when it was safe to reopen and which model we were going to choose and what would prompt a closure. And this was prior to the state coming out with their community map and their metrics. And so we had put some information together, scouring both the DPH website and other sites, and had something that was reasonable. We then integrated the state data, but the big missing piece for us was the regional data, the countywide data, because as Kathleen stated so nicely, that there's challenges of interpreting the data on the community maps when you have very small communities. And our largest town is, I don't even think it's 5,000 people. of our four towns. So we really are using the data to inform conversations with school committee, to inform conversations with our local boards of health around the community metrics that we're using to determine when we would close. We are one of the few districts in Franklin County that is doing a hybrid model of learning. So we have some students in our buildings, and we'll be bringing more in starting next week. Just the region of the county level data, and then also the ability for us to look at the trends is really helpful. In terms of the challenges, one of the things that I know our boards of health are concerned about is understanding when the numbers are indicating community spread, when the numbers are indicating maybe something going on in a congregate setting, or right now there's concern about just the level, the testing within the boarding schools in our communities, and how that's skewing the data at the level of asymptomatic testing. And we've been able to have really good conversations using all of the data on the regional data from your website to really put the testing data itself in context and to be able to, I think, bring the conversation and the knowledge forward for our local boards of health members in terms of understanding the relevance of the different pieces of data to a decision, and also the importance of us having internal data. So I know my time is almost up. I mean, there's a lot more challenges for us being a rural school district. I think in terms of continuing next steps, it's really the testing continues to be a concern of our boards in terms of what will happen if there's a delay in turnaround time or a delay in capacity, and will that create a lag in our ability to respond to community or school-wide trends? And then the challenges of reporting data to our communities and being transparent when in small communities, privacy and confidentiality is critical. And so we're continuing to have conversations with the public health nurses and school administrators around that. So, and I could talk for a lot longer, but my time is up. Thank you.
Christina, you're muted.
She's still muted.
Am I unmuted now? Okay. I can't unmute myself. Sorry about that, everybody. Apologize for that delay. Thank you so much, Meg, for those comments and that insight into the experiences that you've been having. I'd like to ask Gail to join us now in responding to the same questions from your perspective.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Great to see lots of Western Mass folks that I know names and faces of. So thank you as well to the Public Health Institute and others who have orchestrated this. I would just reinforce the value of something that's local, easier to wade through than statewide and state government reports, certainly easier and more reliable potentially than what we're hearing from the federal level. I also just really appreciate the fact that the folks that are looking at this data, analyzing it and depicting it on the dashboard, they live and work and know Western Massachusetts. So I find that very helpful and to me adds that level of confidence in that. They understand our region. So I feel like that's very important. A lot of my work, as you heard earlier, I wear a number of different hats. I live in the community of of Belchertown. I served on their Board of Health for almost two decades. And I'm in that region that we call the Quabog Hills, and it's at the margins of Hamden, Hampshire, and Worcester County. A lot of small towns that you might pass through on your way to somewhere else. And one of the, what we're working on in terms of the first question, really also letting those smaller communities and the community leaders, both official and unofficial, informal community leaders, coalitions, and different entities know about the dashboard and how to use it and how to look at it from their perspective. Again, sometimes countywide data can be very helpful. I appreciate that. But when you are in a community where work and commerce and school districts and just life in general often cross county boundaries, mm-hmm. It's sometimes a challenge to compare what's happening in your sphere to what's happening at a countywide level, particularly when you are farther away from some of the major urban areas in those counties. So that's just one challenge that a region like the Quabog Hills faces. There are other regions in the state, I think, who have similar kinds of challenges. I appreciate what Meg said about regional school districts. That happens in our region as well, that if you're trying to get a good handle on what's happening and what kinds of decisions should be made with respect to school and how it's operating, when you have multiple municipalities, that becomes a bit of a challenge. How do you look at that data? How do you understand it? How does that help you inform decision making? Just one, you know, an additional challenge, and I would just raise it, and maybe our elected state level officials can also look at it. I absolutely support the concepts that looking at a deeper level at race, ethnicity, age, gender, other kinds of demographic factors, very important to get a picture of what's happening in a community or region. I would add economics to that because, again, in the Quabog Hills region, where racially it is predominantly a white region in that sense, we have small percentages of African American, Latino, even Asian, Native American, Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, but small percentages. Many of the community members at highest risk are the lowest economic level, and they are in those frontline jobs where they may be most exposed potentially, those lower wage jobs. So I would just make a plug for, I know that adds a whole nother layer of data analysis, but I feel like economics and how this pandemic has shown both racial, ethnic, and other inequities, it's also really, you know, shined a light on the economic inequities. So that's just one challenge that I think that we're facing. Next steps to be working on, further communicating the availability of the dashboard, helping organizations and groups understand it. And then I would add, how does this data help us to reinforce the kinds of collective action that we want our communities to take, both at the individual family level, how are you protecting you and the people you care about? How are you then helping to protect your community? Are you following guidelines? And can we reinforce the continuation and sustainability of those behaviors? One concern I sometimes have is because we are so anxious for this to feel like it is done, when we hear that numbers are improving and things are getting better, very, very human-like behavior to want to revert to our old habits. And how do we continue to support the majority of people who I think are taking the right measures and behaving in ways we would want to support and reinforce, but how do we sustain it, particularly in smaller communities where sometimes we feel like, well, we're done, we're finished, we're not so bad. It's a big city problem, and how, you know, what we all can do in our various roles to sustain that, I think, is just another step going forward and another challenge that we might face.
Can you hear me? Oh, great. Thank you so much. I want to take a moment to just acknowledge each of your thoughts and comments so far, and appreciate the fact that you're coming at this from unique perspectives in some ways, and still with quite a bit of overlap. The charge is clear that there are very real barriers that each of you in representing your communities or your constituents are facing in terms of the level and quality of the data that are even being made available, but also the call to action to be able to have access to those data and then make use of those data in meaningful ways that are both sustainable but are also responsive to how the pandemic is changing over time. So thank you. And we have a series of really important questions that have shown up in the chat. I know that we want to use the majority of the remaining period to jump into a question and answer section. And so I'd like to offer either Jessica an opportunity to call out some of the questions or for individual questions to be brought up.
Yeah, well, why don't we, thank you, Christina, and thank you, everyone. Why don't we jump back up to the questions that came through right after Kathleen's presentation, which are much more specific to the dashboard.
Okay.
So, Kathleen, the question from Steph Solis is, you mentioned a possible limitation in the county level data, but are there any particular limitations, i.e. data you wish you saw at the community level?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Thanks for asking that and raising that one up, Jessica. I think some of the same types of data we speak to at the county level, and as Gail has brought up as well, would be helpful to hear. So some of the understanding more about disaggregation, particularly by age and other things. But one of the things that I think has been really important and brought up as well is the context that this is happening. And Meg brought this up, whether it's happening in for a congregate living situation. So for example, are we seeing an increase in cases, and it's mostly driven because there was an outbreak at a long-term care facility and thus not indicative of community spread? I think that's what people in our communities are wanting to understand so that they can make decisions in schools, in other places, about whether they need to, if they're continue or go remote or whatever decisions that they're making. So I think that, and that's about having information flow and context for the data as part of it. I think that's what we're hearing most. And then it's not community level, but again, we heard some of this from Meg and Gail. We've been hearing from people about regional school districts. And as Representative Dahm is saying, having that data where it's combined for regional school districts. So it's not at the county level, it's more than community, but having it so that it is accessible, easily accessible to people to use for decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And then Kelly Tice had a couple of specifics. She said, I noticed some weeks overlap, how does that work? Mm-hmm. And then the second is, do you think we'll ever get statistics by race and ethnicity?
Okay. So again, very good questions. And we've received the questions about overlapping weeks from a few different folks, even emails on the dashboard. It is confusing. And I was trying to explain when I was presenting, and I think that even still, it's confusing. So the state is doing essentially 2-week periods, and it's a rolling 2-week period. So there is some overlap. So for some on their daily dashboard example, if they're doing a prior 2-week period, then it's being reported daily and it makes more sense to people because the weekly report is coming out and it's for the prior 2-week period or the 2-week period from that report, then, and they compare from one daily or weekly report to the previous week's report, then they are the state is comparing data where there is an overlap for 1 week of that. I had mentioned that part of the doing the rolling estimates is to be able to understand changes, but then some smoothing when there's daily variability. So it is confusing to people, and we've thought about changing, but we have an advisory group that we've spoken with as well, and we feel that it's important to keep it consistent with how the state is reporting and comparing, which is why we've kept it as it is. I hope that answers the question. It's a confusing thing to explain. And then regarding the race and ethnicity data, I'm not certain. I had put in a request to the state in the late spring and then again over the summer to get the race and ethnicity data, and we have not been able to get it. I know that they have a lot going on at the state level. I'm hopeful with Representative Dahm's legislation that she is putting forth that includes having data reported by county and race and ethnicity disaggregated, amongst other things, that we may be able to see it. But so far.
Tom, would you like to respond to that piece of legislation?
Thank you. Well, I hope we do. I mean, one way or the other, either legislation will compel it or they'll start sharing it, in addition to age breakdown, which we talked about. Listening to what Gail suggested, and then the second question, I started thinking about something that we had not included in the draft legislation, which I can still include, which is exposure category. Because I think that income is more going to be like sort of in Kathleen's neck of the woods of looking at census data and maybe overlaying that in with it. But occupation, congregate housing, like those kinds of, how did that exposure happen? In the very beginning of the pandemic, they listed exposure categories. And then when the numbers got so immense, they stopped. They just assumed everything was community spread, or the majority was community spread. Mm-hmm. But I think we can make the case that on the county level, we need to roll it back a little bit. The numbers are not that much significant. We should be able to do it. And this might be an interesting way of getting occupation, and that would be a way to document the impact on essential workers. So I'm going to take that with me, and I'm going to work with the people at Mass Committee on Occupational Safety and Health and sort of tweak that a little bit and to include it. I don't know if that'll make it happen, but we've discovered that legislation sometimes gives the governor a good nudge. So We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Jessica, before you go to the next one, yeah. I just wanted to ask Representative Dahm if I could just ask, in addition to race, ethnicity, would there be a way to include language? And I'm asking because the research at Caring Health has really found that even within racial categories, you have very diverse cultural backgrounds and cultural and religious practices and beliefs. So for instance, in our count of white patients, that might actually represent Arabic speaking or Russian speaking or English speaking, and that can represent a vast range of general cultural health belief practices and context in which people might need the information rolled out in different ways. Just curious if that would be able to be added.
I can certainly add it. I think I want to just point out that I think the big difference between collecting the data on COVID-19 and, like, let's say HIV or AIDS, mm-hmm. is that the data is not coming from a case report form, which would be filled out by a physician who would be seeing the patient face-to-face, or a medical provider being able to ask these questions, complete it, and send it in. That's how it's done with disease surveillance. Mm-hmm. But this is based on testing surveillance. Mm-hmm. So it's based on what people report on their forms that they're submitting to their testing provider. But that doesn't mean we can't ask for it. I just want to also point out that that's sort of a caveat. Mm-hmm. People can skip. I know in the very beginning when they started releasing race and ethnicity data for the whole state, it was way out of line with the numbers of people because so many people hadn't filled out that information. Mm-hmm. And the testing provider is not the best person to get all that information. So mm-hmm. a trusted medical provider is easier. But we can certainly put preferred language as an indication that we need that information to be able to make good decisions. I love that.
That would be great.
Thank you. And in the time remaining, Michelle, you've been firing off questions in the chat. So I want to give you an opportunity to pick your best question right now to be answered. And then unfortunately, we'll have to start wrapping up. So you can unmute.
Wow, I get to pick one, huh? Wow. Boy, I have so many. One of the things that is running through my head a lot is children at risk. So just children at risk for, they're at risk for the coronavirus, but at risk for hunger in their home, having a parent who's working, so being alone in their home and they're in kindergarten or, you know, whatever. What, I'm in healthcare on compliance. What can we do? What can boards of health do? What can people do to help with that, especially in relation to this dashboard, but in other ways too?
Okay, so we got to troubleshoot who's going to answer that. Any of the panelists want to take a shot at that, at a response for that?
I think that, you know, the thing I'm left with is that we don't even have age breakdown information right now. So we have research that's going on about risk, the risk of infection and the risk of transmission from kids that's coming out. In fact, right now, CDC put out a report that actually demonstrated some, or described some level of vulnerability to not only infection, but illness. But at this point at the state level, we have to convince the department to restore the age breakdown for the state because they've removed that so that we can actually see how many youth are being tested and of that number, how many are positive. But we don't have that data right now. So I would say it kind of goes back, for me, it goes back to getting the information, that data. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, I was going to speak a little bit to it. I don't know if I'll be able to answer fully, but I'm thinking from a school perspective, you know, we do have pretty good knowledge of this, which families within our community are vulnerable in terms of, you know, some data indicators that get reported to the state based on, you know, economic need. And I think an advantage of a small-ish district like ours is that we're able to really reach out directly to families to, you know, to assess whether they have what they need in terms of basics, as well as in terms of what they need for their children to access their education. But it really is a local effort. It's not something that's happening in a more widespread way, though there's a lot of resources, at least Franklin County has a lot of resources available, and a lot of information has been pulled together that with all of the community programs and such for families, but I don't know, it doesn't fully answer your question.
Christina, I just might add too, I've seen some efforts in the Quabog Hills region where medical providers, faith leaders, town officials, law enforcement, other groups are trying to band together to even, you know, reconsider how might we be able to address hunger. I know it's not directly related to the dashboard, but I certainly agree. Most providers are saying that they are seeing increases in those needs with the economic impact of the pandemic, and some collaborations where people are getting very creative in how they might collect, distribute, and refer folks to programs to deal with hunger. And I guess along the way, you know, it's more qualitative, anecdotal information, but it also gives a community a window into what some of its more urgent basic needs might be that may then help shape not only short-term response, but also longer-term efforts to try to, you know, address some of those underlying social inequities that I think were always there, but have been really heightened by the pandemic and maybe hunger and issues of housing instability being two of them.
That's such a good point, Gail, because I see that in my district and between Amherst and Granby in meetings about how groups are forming these collaborations and partnerships. And sometimes it's for the first time, but it's allowing them to see into each other's world, whether it's the Amherst Survival Center and Granby to go get grab and go, and also how they're able to partner with each other. That could be a great second webinar right there.
Go ahead.
I just was going to note that I had put in the chat that many school districts are providing grab and go breakfast and lunch. And I know, you know, in our district, and I'm aware of many other districts that are doing the same, that it's for any resident under the age of 18. And then in some cases, also providing meals to seniors. And those can be, in our district, those can be picked up, but we also, over the summer, did deliver meals. And I think Franklin Tech last spring was using their bus routes to deliver meals around Franklin County. You know, which I think is especially important where you have a county where there's not public transportation. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, the, you know, the cost of gas to get into Greenfield is prohibitive if they live in one of the hill towns, East or East County.
It's one of those things with the pandemic that it's not revealed like we didn't know it, but allowed it to be publicly shared that schools, that we've relied on schools for more than just teaching our kids. We've relied on them to feed our kids, to take care of our kids, to be a second set of eyes on our kids in terms of potential abuse.
Yes.
You know, and I think that many communities, Meg, including in Amherst, they're continuing to have free meal distribution through the end of the calendar year, even for kids who aren't necessarily part of the district.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate your comment about just sort of the school being eyes on kids. That I one of the concerns in our district, and one of the reasons we did work so hard to start with a remote or a hybrid model, was out of concern for students who hadn't had contact with adults outside of their home since early March, and being able to really check in with those families. I know there were reports that the number of reports of abuse and neglect had gone down dramatically. And as I think most of us understand, that doesn't mean that the incidence of abuse and neglect went down dramatically. It just reported by schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to take this time now to really say a heartfelt thanks for all of you spending this past hour with us, asking critical questions. There's clearly so much more work to be done. Mm-hmm. I want to thank the Public Health Institute of Western Mass, Jessica, Kathleen, Sarita, all of the staff at the Institute who have made this dashboard possible and have really seen the need and the gap and chosen to respond by making data accessible at a regional level. And to each of our panelists, Representative Dom, Meg, and Gail, just really many thanks for you thinking through these questions. Clearly, we've carved out some themes that need additional attention in terms of the data that are available and the legislation that we need to get in place in order to have them become available, as well as what we can do with them. And I know there are so many folks on the call. There's an ongoing chat conversation. Sounds like there's, as you mentioned, already the carve out for next steps in terms of where this conversation can head. But really just hoping everyone remains well and safe and continuing to do the difficult but important work that everybody is doing. So thank you. And Jessica, I don't know if you have any final words or if we're all set, but okay, great. Well, thank you and take care. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.